Malcolm Honlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations, joins us for the weekly update here on a Friday, Erev Shabbos Chazon. Mr. Honlein, welcome back to JM in the AM.
Great to be with you, as always.
By the way, folks, I remind you that Malcolm announced last week, October the 15th, will be the big tribute dinner for the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. And once one makes a reservation, Malcolm, they are invited to come and participate in that beautiful event.
That is absolutely true. It'll be a very special, unique one time in 20 years, and God willing, not for another 20 years, dinner that will mark the 50th anniversary of the conference and honoring the past chairman and myself for covering all this period. And I think it'll be very unique in a once-in-a-lifetime event.
No question about that. ABC News put it this way. Israeli police say an ultra-Orthodox soldier has been accosted in a religious Jerusalem neighborhood in a sign of anger over plans to begin drafting religious men into the army. Malcolm, what is the responsible reaction from all sides to this episode?
There has to be an absolutely clear, unequivocal condemnation. And I saw an editorial in the papers like Hamodia. Others have taken this issue on straightforward. And to make sure that it's clear, number one, this does not represent the Haredi community. It doesn't represent any segment of the Haredi community. It was denounced and renounced by leaders from every segment. And that message has to get out clearly. The lax attitude towards a lot of the posters that were put up, demeaning and attacking the IDF and those who serve, the fact that Haredi and religious guys who join Nachal Haredi or other groups have been subjected to this kind of horrific treatment should have been condemned and stopped a long time ago. It's got to be now. And as you know, they just announced a new Machina unit, the defense minister. They're doing things to accommodate the demand that there is for young men who want to come, who go into the service and who are accommodated, their religious needs are accommodated. And certainly they should be recognized and their service appreciated, regardless of whether these other people are serving or not.
For those who've never been to Israel and have never had the privilege of walking the streets of major cities in the Holy Land, we can both attest to the fact that even if there isn't great enthusiasm from all sides for everybody, including soldiers in the Israeli army at all times, there is a certain courtesy that is noticeable from everybody toward Israeli soldiers. So I would like to emphasize, as you just did, but maybe in a different way, that this is a rare exception, and hopefully, please God, with everything that's being negotiated now in the Knesset, hopefully it will stay that way.
And it's the climate that we talk about all the time that has been created on so many fronts, whether it's about the chief rabbis, whether about the political issues, not just involving the religious community generally,
right,
that everything now becomes a divisive issue that excites population, that excites people, rather than cool heads debating, and their differences are legitimate and debate is legitimate, but it has to be done in the right way, and we have to set the standard. I mean, when, if not before Tisha B'Av, and when we mark the destruction of the temple because of Sinat Chinam, that and you know, for the hatred that existed between people, this has always been our downfall, and it's got to be checked.
In one of the lectures that Rabbi Wein presented, actually we heard it today. So he was talking about how one specific personal family issue. You heard that, right?
I know.
Became a community issue. And are you on this side or are you on that side? Very similar, I guess, to what we would call.
I have to tell you that I saw this week on two occasions, completely separate, two of the top people in Israel's high-tech industry, as far from religious as they could be, but both of them got up in different form and spoke in defense of the Haredim and against the demonization. And it shows me that there is a backlash, that people are seeing that the excessiveness of so many of the comments, the articles, these attacks in some of the media there, on all sides, are just completely unacceptable.
Right, yeah, the potential danger that I'm referring to, of course, is, as you just said, is that, God forbid, this one issue can really create such a large gap among brethren. You know, we talk about, God forbid, how things like this can exacerbate and lead to, I don't even want to say what, but, you know, physical war one against the other, and we have to be very careful before, God forbid, it turns in that direction. And by the way, you know, excuse me for being philosophical. Maybe this is a good time because we are right before Tisha B'Av. It struck me this morning, as I'm looking at the New York Times, that we have gotten to a place now where, with all the problems and all the centuries, and sometimes we lose historical perspective, not only can we talk about the state of Israel and all these accomplishments and the amazing, luxurious life that relatively all of us have because of the state in this generation, but the New York, what's the biggest issue in the New York Times this morning? The powder room at the Knesset. What would our predecessors 100, 200, 300 years ago have said if we told them that in 2013, the featured article in the world's most prominent or most prestigious newspaper would be how people are being treated for their specific needs in the Israeli House of Parliament?
They might have applauded it and said, if that's the biggest tzara that the Jews have at that time, then it's a good sign.
Exactly.
But it just shows the how ludicrous the media has become, and how the New York Times and the reports almost every day continue these one-sided, distorted views of every issue related to Israel.
I agree with you, but you understand where I'm coming from a positive vein.
Sure,
and it's, historically, it's just remarkable and unbelievable. All right, the big question, we addressed this last week. I'm sure you have a clearer picture now. The U.S. will not in any way cut any financial aid to Egypt, whether it was a coup or not at this point, right?
They are not. They're trying to avoid it, and I discussed last week the trying to avoid defining what is happening as a coup, because the law mandates immediate and automatic cutoff of funds. So they are being very careful. There are some in Congress who are saying that they should pass some sort of a waiver, and not avoid the use, but say that there would be some sort of a waiver provision introduced that would allow the aid to continue, because Israel and others also feel that right now cutting it off, and we're not talking about a huge transfer of funds right now, because much of the money has been already transferred, or almost all of it, for this year, but because of the message that it would send and undermining the military, there is a feeling that the money should be more directed, i.e., to anti-terrorism activities, and not just give them another group of tanks or planes that they're getting delivered in the next few weeks. So given the situation, given the especially the situation in the Sinai and the disruption there, and the fact that their troops are spread now in many areas where they haven't been for a long time, even along the Suez Canal, because there had been an attempt to fire a Grad missile there, or the killing of their soldiers in the Sinai, and the mobilization of this war council by the Muslim Brotherhood and Hamas's organizing together with others and sending people from Gaza into the Sinai to attack Egyptian troops there, but also to operate against Israel. And you know, they found a missile that had been fired against Eilat from Egypt, and it's not necessarily even Hamas, it's Islamic Jihad. You have Al Qaeda, you have many other groups that are operating there, and people, you know, tend to look at Egypt in a narrow sense but don't think about what's happening. There are attempts now to target Israelis, even Israeli Arabs, to kill the tourism business in Egypt. And the Muslim Brotherhood together has armed cells together with Al Qaeda and Hamas's armed cells that are organizing. Some of the tunnels have been shut down, but they still have enough to operate and to get into the Sinai. They killed a couple of Egyptian soldiers and police, and there were a number of attacks even on an airport again. So this is the aid that we give should be to aid and assist the people who are the Egyptian troops in fighting the terrorist organizations there.
All right, and if not for that, if the U.S. did not feel that Egypt was a really important front line ally in fighting those terrorists, would they strongly consider taking away the financial aid, or is this just a convenient excuse?
They would suspend it.
They would suspend it.
Yeah, I think that well, there is a lot of anger because the United States the appearance is that the United States was backing Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood. The signs that one sees at the demonstrations, which are not, by the way, broadly reported, but the signs all over condemning the American ambassador, condemning the U.S. The president, the administration, for backing Morsi, and the fact is that there was an election. He was elected, but certainly not in the interests, long-term interests of the United States, to see the Muslim Brotherhood continue. You see how the Saudis and the Kuwaitis rushed in with $8 billion and $4 billion, respectively, in aid, which counters the money that Qatar was pouring into the Muslim Brotherhood government and into Hamas. And one of the tests now is to see, and Congress is going to measure and send a notice to the ambassador of Qatar saying that the relationship is going to be contingent with the United States, will be contingent on their stopping their aid to Hamas and terrorist groups. But the situation in Egypt right now and the desire to see some sort of stability. But the fact is that even with all this aid, these are temporary buy-offs when the economy, as we know, is in total shutdown. The order now to arrest more of the Islamic Brotherhood's leaders, including the Supreme Guide, is going to exacerbate the tensions. And today, being the Friday and after the services in the mosques, we'll see. This is the time when Muslim Brotherhood demonstrators come out. They're threatening campaigns of violence. They're threatening to escalate the violence and attack and assassinate leaders and others. So the situation is far from stable. 90 people, I think, were killed this week. The militia groups that exist are going to only escalate. And the Salafists, who are the more extreme of the Muslim Brotherhood, and their war council, are going to try to take advantage of this.
You know what?
They rally the Islamists, even if the Muslim Brotherhood has lost some of their support.
You know what's so amazing is, and it must be, amazing for the political scientists to analyze this, but it is amazing how important so many countries feel a stable Egypt is. As if it's like an anchor of the Middle East.
Well, it is. It's the biggest country. It's the most prestigious. It's now not necessarily the most powerful. And you see the intensity, and I point out last week, remember how all the different countries react. Well, look how this week it was borne out with Iran being very happy with Morsi's downfall and the Syrians and the others, but the ramifications that they see, the ramifications, let's say, for Hamas, that they don't have the Muslim Brotherhood government to rely on, but on the other hand, it could enhance Iran's leverage with Hamas, which could escalate the violence, and Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood continue the cooperation with the IDF for their own reasons, but they continued it. On the other hand, a democratic revolution in Cairo could ultimately elevate their standing again and be a model that will scare places like Egypt and Turkey.
Right. And we may owe a debt of gratitude in the long run to the protesters.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We don't know how this is going to break up. One of the byproducts of all of this, of course, is that Syria took the focus off Iran. Now Egypt took the focus off Syria.
Right.
And in the meantime, Iran is racing ahead towards a nuclear program. You know, people hardly write about it today. There will be articles because of new assessments that of the State Department that Iran's ballistic missiles will be set to test in a year and a half or so, but talking about China, North Korea, and Iran becoming nuclear capable countries, meaning having nuclear warheads capable of being fired with ballistic missiles, etc. And there's been little attention. The MEK, the Mujahideen in Iran, released a report this week, and they've been the source of a lot of the information on the nuclear program, that in Damavandan, which is southeast of Tehran, there is another nuclear facility that has been, till now, undisclosed.
And I assume it's deep underground or not necessarily?
Underground, inside a mountain.
America's one and only Jewish Moments in the Morning radio program, heard on listeners sponsored WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, WNYX Montgomery, Rockland County at 91.9 on the FM dial, around the world on the web, jmnam.org. Malcolm Honlein on this Erev Shabbos Chazon weekly update here at JM in the AM. So Israel then, just going back for a moment to the Egyptian attempts to thwart terrorism in the northern Sinai, Israel then must be keeping a very keen eye on Egypt's military buildup there. Not that that would surprise anybody, but it must demand even more attention right now.
It demands a lot of attention, and Israel has to give permission, and hopefully the Egyptians will continue to ask for permission to engage in the buildup. You see some of the anti-Israel, anti-Jewish sentiment that's expressed, and of course, you know, people blaming the uprisings there and everywhere else, as they do in Turkey, on Israel or Jewish lobby or something Jewish that becomes a convenient scapegoat, but the people don't buy it. You don't see people carrying signs and things like that indicating that they buy into the lies. But for Israel, absolutely right that this has to be a major concern when you see the buildup. They gave permission for 30 tanks, for instance, to go and protect the Suez Canal. When there was an attempt to fire a Grad missile there were other movements on the part of forces, and this threatens Israel. And Israel's ability to work across the border into the Sinai is limited because it's Egyptian territory governed by the Egyptian army, and they had one response, if you remember, not long ago, where some Egyptian soldiers were hurt or killed even. So for Israel, the effectiveness of the Egyptian army is very important. On the other hand, you don't want to allow such a force to build up that could eventually turn against them.
What about the buildup up north? And I'm referring now not to its neighbors, but to Israel itself, because I read again this morning how the IDF has a more of a buildup this week on the Syrian border. Is that because there's more likelihood, as opposed to last time when Hezbollah really attacked from Lebanon, that Hezbollah, if they would, God forbid, spray rocket fire on Israel, it would happen from Syria?
Well, the rocket fire would happen more likely from Lebanon, and that's where the mass of the rockets in Hezbollah's hands, and Syria has many long-range missiles capable of hitting Tel Aviv. There are reports this week that Assad gave permission to heat up the Golan border, but not to go so far as to warrant a full-scale retribution by Israel. And as you know, there were several incidents where Israelis' jeeps came under fire, rockets fired. Now, many of them were coincidental, was because of fighting between various factions in Syria, and some of it may have been directed at Israel, but Israel's response immediately is to take out whatever the offending force was.
But would it be fair to say that in 2006, when Israel had rockets rained upon them from Lebanon, they didn't really have to worry about the Syrian border, or that would not be accurate?
Yeah, that is accurate, because he's kept the border quiet, but it's a little bit of a myth, because he used Hezbollah in Lebanon to attack.
Right, so the question is, would that range of potential, you know, rocket fire now expand?
The only reason he would do it, I mean, his fear of Israel striking back is that would further destabilize or wipe out his regime, because it could wipe him out.
Right.
And a really strong Israeli attack and diminishing the capacity of the government forces could shift the balance, although we see today the divisions within the rebel groups, the seesawing in a lot of the battles, Israel, there was an attack on an anti-ship missile facility that was storing these new anti-ship missiles that came from Russia that were hit in a naval barracks near Latakia. Israel denied its involvement, but the locals all said it was some foreign source, so maybe it came from somewhere else. But there are attacks, there are things going on, because Israel can't allow the shift in the balance with Hezbollah gaining, not only that they're getting battle experience, though it's limited, and they are losing many men, and there are a lot of protests by the families of Hezbollah fighters against Nasrallah, and Nasrallah sent representatives to Iran this week to tell the Iranians that they can't sustain this alone anymore, and that they want more Iranian troops to be brought in to join in the fighting. And a Hezbollah stronghold near Beirut was hit by a huge, what was described as a car bomb, but it's not clear whether it was a car bomb, but it blew up an important facility of Hezbollah. So they're not immune from this. They could divert, and the point is that both Syria or Hezbollah and or Hezbollah could divert attention mm-hmm. from their domestic problems by heating up the borders with Israel. None of them want an all-out war. They know that Israel will strike strong and clearly without restrictions that were imposed last time before Hezbollah was part of the new government. And Hezbollah is very stretched. You know, after his visit to Tehran and Damascus, he sent 20 more battalions into Syria. So he's very extended. He's facing internal problems. One of the senior commanders was killed this past week. And I think they will be reluctant to take any too adventuristic a stage.
So for those of us observers who might say things are eerily quiet, would you say, Nahum, they're not as quiet as you think they are?
It's always beneath the surface. There's a lot boiling. The good thing is that they're focused on each other and not on Israel right now. We see that the killing continues. That the New York Times doesn't give it so much attention to, doesn't think it's important what they're doing to Christians. The cops in Egypt, again, in each of these cases, they are focusing on one another and not on Israel. So for Israel right now, yeah. It is relatively good and stable, and there's no enemy right now that could take on Israel, and there's certainly no indication that they could unify.
Today. Two quick things, if we could do them quickly. So Mansour took over for Morsi. Is he still president at this point?
Of course.
No,
he'll be president for the next for 4.5 months. He wants to have to prepare a revised constitution, and then in 6 months have parliamentary elections, and then presidential elections.
Okay. And Hezbollah's Muslim Brotherhood strength. Because a week ago, we were talking about the death of the Muslim Brotherhood. How would you describe their strength today?
No, they're still the best organized, and if there was an election today, they probably would win because they can turn out significant numbers, and it may even be the Salafists, which is what...
Even with this air of revolution, they would still win the election?
Well, they're 20 to 25%, but remember, you have the other groups are so divided and so pit against each other and not well organized in a national way. Although this time you had perhaps 10 million people, they say, in the streets, and if those people are motivated to vote, which they weren't last time, then you could end up with a really secular...
So Egypt needs a really inspiring leader, and they don't have it at the moment.
Exactly right. And you see that he appointed El Baradei vice president for international affairs. He tried to appoint him as prime minister, but there was a big backlash, fortunately. And so this is an interim government. This is not a government that will be able to last a long time.
By the way, what did NSA whistleblower Snowden reveal about Stuxnet this week? Anything dangerous to Israel, or just confirm that Israel was involved in the project?
Well, asserting that Israel was involved, but we understand that there's still a lot more to come out.
And we've spoken a lot about Venezuela on this program, and you've spoken about its leadership, attitude toward Jews, etc. What do you think when you heard that Snowden may end up there?
Not surprising, because they will give safe haven and refuge like Cuba to anybody who's anti-American, and they also have laws that prevent extradition. And it's just further evidence that nothing has changed, even though this is the new president is much quieter than Chavez. And Iran, as we know, and we described for a long time, had already looked for alternatives. And we saw the product of that this week when Argentina prevented the prosecutor, Alberto Nisman, to go to Washington, where he was invited to Congress to testify about the report he gave about the activities over the past three decades of Iran in establishing a big terror network in South America. And he's also the one who's investigating the bombings of the Israeli embassy and the Jewish Community Center. And he says that Iran was the main sponsor of the attempt in 2007 to attack the JFK airport and many other things. And Argentina didn't allow him come to talk about it.
Have you been updated on the health of the wife of the Secretary of State?
From what I heard yesterday from people there was that they suspect a seizure, but they don't have yet the cause, and she's being transferred now to a rehabilitation place. She's out of the hospital and obviously the most serious phase.
There was a report this week that a senior PA official, and by the way, this is a report that I think we could talk about every week, but anyway, that you can confirm or deny, that a senior PA official met secretly with the Prime Minister of Israel, Bibi Netanyahu. These negotiations, like I say, are going on a regular basis behind the scenes or not?
There are reports of these activities. There are exchanges between people representing the Prime Minister and their counterparts, like Molcho, whose responsibility it is. Tzipi Livni, I think, had discussions with people. She's in charge of the negotiations, but there's no serious exchanges or negotiations going on a second track or third track. Right?
Even when the Prime Minister himself was involved. And I guess
that the Prime Minister was...
Oh, so this report from this week may not be true.
Right.
Interesting.
Well, they always say that it's high level, and they don't mention it, so everybody then runs to assume because they want to get a denial, but then the information about who it really was.
Right, and I'm sure the Prime Minister would be vague if asked in a press conference about it anyway. So.
Well, you see the calls now in the PA calling for a third intifada, for escalation, and the Israeli military talked about an escalation. There's a group that operates, one of the Hezbollah type groups released information on 5,000 and 6,000 attacks in the first 6 months, although the Army statistics released this week also show a drop, and saying that because there aren't attempts, but because the IDF's activities have been so spectacular there in preventing the terrorist attacks.
Speaking of Israeli politics, the cabinet has now approved a bill to draft yeshiva students. I believe two things. Number one, this has to go to the Knesset and sit through some arguments back and forth before any type of vote. And number two, you would say that this is still far, far from being completed or becoming law, right?
This is still far from becoming law, and I'm sure there'll be many debates and changes, and even if they pass it, it's not something that'll be implemented, and all of a sudden you're going to have mass conscriptions of people. The Army can't even absorb all of the people right now. So
I read an article this morning about the Army, about the IDF really cutting back 4,000 lifetime personnel being laid off, and certain types of weaponry manufacturing being discontinued. I mean, is the Israeli Army going through, is the IDF in general going through
retrenchment?
Yeah, an era of cutbacks?
Everybody's going through, and that's part of the pressure, and one of the reasons why, you know, the focus is only on the cuts in yeshivas and some others, but the whole society is being affected. Every minister I met was so preoccupied with dealing with the cuts to their budgets and how they were going to accommodate that, and that, of course, leads to unemployment of people and has all sorts of ramifications in society.
Oh, no question about that. Can you tell me about this deal, whether it's significant or not? A historical agreement has been signed between Israel and the Vatican, ending a 20-year dispute. Israel has granted the Pope an official seat in the room where the Last Supper is believed to have taken place on Mount Zion in Jerusalem. Was there anybody opposed to this agreement?
Well, yes, there has been a debate because also there were sovereignty issues that were at one time debated, but I think that it's resolved and it's exactly as you described it.
Malcolm, I wrap up this conversation, Erev Tisha B'Av or Erev Shabbos Chazon, with a very important topic. I just read an article, in fact, that the member of Knesset Moshe Feiglin wrote about it. You know, we thank God. I'm not at all demeaning this. I mean, you've been part of the effort to do whatever possible to stop the destruction and the vandalism on Har HaZeitim, on the Mount of Olives, right? That has been somewhat of a successful campaign. What can we do to stop the vandalism and the destruction of artifacts on the Temple Mount, which I would have to argue is an even more important site than any others that we could discuss on this program? Is it simply trying to motivate people to be as enthusiastic and emotional about it as they are about other sites?
Well, first of all, on the Har HaZeitim, and I'm glad you raised it, we had a meeting of the committee here, the American part of the committee, which is chaired by Abe Lubinsky and Menachem and others, people who have family there, people who are really devoted and dedicated to it, and people in Israel who are working on it, meeting with ministers, meeting with the government. I will be doing it when I go to Israel this week again, as I did 2 weeks ago, because we still see violence there. We still
Correct.
See that the promises have not been implemented.
They've done it. You've done a great job on this. How do we get the same type of passion to Har HaBayit to stop what's going on there?
It's one of the things that is really frustrating that you see all the attention given to the discovery of this part of the Sphinx in Israel.
Right. And look how Israel treated it.
And they treat it with such respect. And this is a discovery at Hatzor,
right,
in northern Israel, and it is a very significant archaeological find. But here, things so close to us and so to the core of our very existence, of all that we are, that we hear marking Tisha B'Av, and you remember Napoleon was once driving in Paris and he heard people crying, and he sent his lieutenant in, and he came out and he said, what are all the crying and screaming? And he said, because they're mourning the destruction of their temple 1900 years ago. And he said, any people that mourns for 1900 years is destined to return.
Yep.
I mean, we pray for the return. We sit on the floor, we mourn, and now we see the very essence of the history there being destroyed or being desecrated. And the government has to order the police. They have taken some measures. It isn't as widespread as some people describe it, but it is serious, because the Palestinian administration, we now turned over theoretically to the Jordanians, but it's the Waqf there that is in control. And Israeli police are often reluctant or afraid to go into some of the areas, and what they're doing underground, out of sight. We know that the hundreds of tons of stuff that were taken off are still being sifted, and will be for years to come. So this is a good time to be reminded that everybody should make their voices heard. We have to demand that the desecration, and at the same time that they are, of course, continuing, and the Palestinians are engaging in the denial of any connection and attacking the very essence. And you can't have that kind of incitement, the continuing honoring of terrorists, as we saw this week, and the anti-Israel popular incitement that goes on in the media and elsewhere has to stop. And the line has to be drawn by Israel on what happens in Har Habayit.
We gotta think.
Two central places. You lose these places. What is there that we can then stand up and say, this is our heritage. This is why we've mourned for 2,000 years for the rebuilding of the temple.
Got to figure out a way to motivate people on this. And I'm sure. I mean, look, it's always on your.
People who have family, their relatives. The committee needs funding. They're looking to build a visitor center. They have all sorts of extensive plans that are being considered, and they need support. And there are hundreds of thousands of people buried there, many of them, tens of thousands, I think, of relatives in the United States as in Israel. And finally, the issue is on the map because of this persistent effort and the constant visits and the pressure of the committee in Israel, the committee here. And this has to be sustained.
No,
only way, because the government is pressured in so many different ways, and then all the change in personnel. So everybody we work out deals with everybody who was supposed to address certain issues around the Har Habayit. You know, then they change, and the next one doesn't. You have to start all over again.
Well, understood. But if there was a lot of motivation, it would be
100% right.
It would be an issue that would remain constant. And
maybe the new ambassador coming to the United States will help convey the message.
Well, you know him.
I know him well.
So, what do you think? Is he somebody who would put this on his agenda?
Oh, absolutely. I think he will when he comes, and people will make the case to him strongly. He's comes from an Orthodox family, was born in Miami, so he has great communication skills. He'll be a strong advocate. You see how the media is trying to box him in because of his past Republican associations, but I think he will overcome that and will make him an advocate for us.
Yes or no, will Iran and Syria get onto the Human Rights Council?
Right now, the indications are, as ludicrous as it may sound, that they will again.
Wow.
On the
wow.
On the wow. It's almost hard to be serious when you talk about it, but it just tells you what the Human Rights Council really is about. That the massive killings and countries that are violating human rights all over the Middle East can be elevated in that body. And one of the concerns, of course, that we have, and we have the UN General Assembly coming in early in September, and it'll be around the Chagim, so it limits our ability to have all the meetings with foreign leaders, but the Palestinians are likely to move, and that's one of the reasons why Secretary Kerry, I think, is putting on the pressure to come back, because as long as the talks are alive, it doesn't give them the opportunity, or it limits their opportunity. But we think the Palestinians want to try and kill the negotiations, so it'll pave the way for them to be able to make, again, a series of unilateral moves at the United Nations to gain recognition.
All right. Malcolm is in Israel next week, folks. We will let you know. Pay careful attention to this show, because as soon as Tisha B'Av ends, we will know whether he'll be able to join us schedule-wise next Friday or not, and we'll update you accordingly. Malcolm, a wonderful Shabbos. Have an easy fast, and hopefully we'll speak again next week.
And a meaningful fast to everyone, to think about the real meaning of Tisha B'Av with all of the visiveness of how each of us can contribute to helping foster unity amongst the Jewish people, within the Jewish people, and our commitments to assure the sanctity and safety of Har HaBayit and of Har HaZeitim.
Thank you so much. Malcolm Hohenlein is Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Fridays at 7:40 Eastern Time. That's when we present the weekly update.